The 2014 World Cup is almost over, and this was a great tournament with tons of goals and compelling storylines and dramatic moments. I'm so glad that part of my time off allowed me to fully immerse myself in this event. Over the years, I've seen a little bit more, read a little more, and this was the fulfillment of those efforts. Being able to watch almost every game and have time to get a sense of what was going on from other perspectives allowed for a more well-rounded and memorable tournament. Who knows if I'll be able to do this in 2018. Just wanted to share some of my thoughts from this tournament. Starting with the group stage, Michael Cox summarized what we learned for ESPN FC. Quote, there are various good sides at this tournament with mid-ranking teams boasting excellent footballers and lesser squads who are disciplined and organized. For once, a football cliche is true. At this level, there are no easy games. End quote. He noted that part of this is the fact that in the 12 years since Japan-South Korea, players and managers are more experienced, and this has closed the gap between the underdogs and the favorites. David Hershey's group stage recap focused on the colors red, white, and blue and another England failure. He was at a local watering hole for the US-Germany game as this American squad played well despite mistakes and injuries and got a little help from a certain World Player of the Year in the Portugal-Ghana match. Then he wondered if Holland and France could put past drama behind them and deliver on their promise. Finally, England fell short again, as they always do, due to, quote, clueless defending, a stodgy midfield, and the inability to kick a ball in the general vicinity of goal. End quote. Spot on, I'd say. ESPN put together the five best goals of the group stage. RVP versus Spain, Cahill against Holland, Jones against Portugal, Shaqiri against Honduras, and Messi against Nigeria. All nice goals, but what about the goal Duarte scored for Costa Rica against Uruguay? Diving header, just inches off the ground, boot in his face, all the way to the far post. Then there was Gervinho against Colombia, which was a fine individual effort. Or Benzema's against Switzerland after a fantastic ball from Pogba. And Müller's winner against the United States wasn't too bad either. One quick note about the protest element of this tournament. Most things with me come down to time management, and I would rather be entertained and distracted by the footy than what was happening in and around the stadium. I would read an article from time to time and get an update on the Howler Dummy podcast, but I did not put the energy into researching and engaging the protest aspect of the World Cup that I did into the play on the field. I admit I got sucked into the festival of football. Moving on to some notes about some of the bigger nations that did not have success. Peter Allegi decompressed after the Italy debacle against Uruguay and then wrote a piece for his blog, Football's Coming Home. There was a lot of evaluation and introspection of the Italian team, which Allegi admitted was average but should still have qualified for the second round. He felt that Italy were robbed due to two key referee decisions, the Marchisio red and the Suarez bite. While Marchisio could have been shown a yellow, referees were clearly punishing any tackle with exposed studs, with Antonio Valencia of Ecuador and Stefan Defour of Belgium as other examples. For the Suarez incident, not sure that the referee crew could have seen such a thing, so don't know how Suarez gets sent off in the moment. The next two World Cup cycles will see a regeneration of the squad. I'm interested to see what kind of Azzurri team takes the field in 2016 and 2018. Then there was Spain, the defending champions. Jimmy Burns wrote, quote, against Chile, as against Holland, Spain lacked creativity, passion, and capacity to score goals. No sense of self-worth, no team ethos, with its vulnerability increasingly exposed as the game progressed. Unquote. Was this team hungry enough for more success when they won so much for club and country? Costa was shoehorned into the side, and the subs were not up to it. Just a poor performance all around. This is another team that will need some reshaping over the next two tournament cycles. There were other stories as well. Wright Thompson wrote a lot of amazing stuff before and during the World Cup. He posted a piece on ESPN FC shortly after Bosnia-Herzegovina won their final group match over Iran, their only points of the tournament. He shared his thoughts from a visit to Mostar, which is a divided city in Bosnia-Herzegovina between the Muslim Bosnians and Catholic Croatians. The scars of war are still evident, and now with the World Cup over, players and fans go back to daily life, with the more hardcore elements still trying to perpetuate the conflict. Depressing stuff. On the July 8th Howler Dummy podcast, Sean Jacobs, New School professor and founder of the blog Africa as a Country, joined the panel to talk about the behind-the-scenes conflicts faced by some of the Africa teams at this World Cup. There was Nigeria, where Keshi was able to insulate the team from events back home, Cameroon, whose players threatened before the tournament, and then Song lashed out against an opponent, and Benoit Assiokoto confronted a teammate. Algeria appeared harmonious and had success, while Ivory Coast went with the golden generation and still couldn't progress. Finally, there was Ghana, who had poor tournament preparations and dysfunctional FA, and this led to a player strike before the Portugal match. Money had to be flown in, taxed by Brazil, and then delivered to the players. The conversation opened my eyes as to why these players have such turbulent tournaments and a reminder that this is only a game. Then there's the United States. I didn't have them getting out of the group of death. I didn't use the hashtag I believe in my tweets. My opinion is that they would grind and effort and all that but fall short due to a lack of goals and really tough competition. I was wrong. For me, the best game was against Portugal. After an early setback, they regrouped, possessed the ball, and created chances. That was a game I enjoyed and wish there was more of that from the Stars and Stripes. Against Belgium, the US was sorry and should have been out of the match much sooner. Okay, big picture. In the 90s, everyone was US this, Project 2010 that, blah blah blah. My response, we weren't even the best team on our continent. That has now changed. US and Mexico are 1 and 1A, so we are making progress in that regard. And we are making progress at the World Cup. We have some hiccups, I'm looking at Steve Sampson, but we have made successive second rounds. The team's technical ability still needs to improve, and that will take some time. In 2018, the second round should be the bare minimum. After that, it's matchups and a little luck. Of all the articles I read in the aftermath of the U.S.'s defeat, I really thought Jeff Carlisle captured it the best. The U.S. was promised something, yet every game seemed to be a repeat of previous matches. Defend, hang on, scrape through, lose dramatically. Klinsmann is being paid a lot and will need to use fresh, younger recruits to execute his vision. Now is the time to deliver. For some thoughts on Klinsmann, here are some posts I found. If you haven't checked out the Fusion website, soccer.fusion.net, please give it a look. Thought-provoking articles, games boiled down to a series of GIFs, and a lot of good content. I read Simon Evans' article, which posed the question, would Americans like Klinsmann if he were American? I didn't realize that Americans didn't like Klinsmann. Anyway, he began the article using quotes from former coach Bruce Arena, who said that America should be coached by an American using American-born players playing in the MLS. I couldn't disagree more. For me, the coach should be the best qualified person. Evans states the following about Klinsmann. Quote, he was one of the finest players in Europe in his day. He went on to coach Germany and Bayern Munich. He judges players not by the standards of what Arena so frequently calls the American player, but by global standards. Everything he has done in terms of nutrition, fitness, tactics, and motivation is aimed towards bringing his players up to an elite international level, and he doesn't seem to care who takes offense. End quote. The issue of dual citizenship is tricky. Are players really playing for the U.S. or because they couldn't make the team of their birth country? In the end, who cares? If they help make the team more successful, then sign them. The Orundi of Italy helped them win World Cups. African-born players have helped European teams for years. Look at the French national team that won the 98 World Cup. Or the Brazilian-born players, defender Pepe, midfielder Deco, and striker Leidson, who raised the level of the Portugal team over the last several years. As for where players play, again, not a concern for me. I would just ask two things. Are the players playing consistently, and are the players being challenged? Julian Green on Bayern Munich does not impress me. He's not playing consistently yet. Dempsey and Bradley coming back to the U.S. is good, because they are playing almost every game and are taking a leadership role. In the end, Evans identifies what Klinsmann's role is. Quote, Klinsmann is no different from the highly paid outside consultant brought into a corporation to criticize everything its hardworking staff has ever achieved. He's here, probably for a while, and only in 5 to 10 years will we know if he was worth the money. End quote. Livy Bird argued that Jurgen should smash the system. His post for the Telegraph website stated the case again that the player development system in this country is broken. America is stuck in a pay-to-play mode, and that means that players are missed and that players are not developed on par with the rest of the world. Maybe Jurgen will implement changes in the next 4 years, but he has an uphill battle against the current power structure and the lack of immediate results. The question bubbling under the surface of bomb pop jerseys and giant watch parties and Tim Howard fever was, has soccer arrived? Scott Yashanis wrote an article for the Lansing State Journal answering the question, has soccer caught on? He said yes. It's caught on in Lansing and in America. Between the watch parties held all over the city of Lansing during the World Cup, especially for U.S. games, and the record-breaking TV ratings, the game is part of the American sports landscape. Is interest higher during the World Cup? Yes. Is interest higher when the U.S. does well? Yes. But interest continues during the club season and even during the European championships. Then there was the whole Ann Coulter brouhaha. To be honest, I didn't engage it at all. That's what she wanted. As I stated during this series, I don't care what you think about soccer. I'm not going to fight with you about it. Well, I might, but not in this form, and unless I have a couple of drinks in me. One article I came across in my interaction with the World Cup was from Phil West, who's been traveling around the United States and writing about this World Cup in preparation for a forthcoming book, We Want the World, Watching the World Cup Through American Eyes. He wrote about his field trip in Seattle, going from venue to venue to see how the city was experiencing the matches. Great story, and I look forward to his book. One thing that has been gnawing at me the last several years and finally broke through into my consciousness is that I'm an American, and from a soccer/football perspective, I better start acting like one. I've been poo-pooing U.S. soccer, both the MLS and U.S. national team, focusing my time and energy on La Liga or EPL, and knowing more about Spanish, Croatian, and French national teams than my own. For the MLS, I've slowly increased my awareness and knowledge. I've started subscribing to a couple of podcasts. I've started a project to visit all the MLS stadiums. I am trying. As for the U.S. national team, I really don't know anything except Del Cesaro. So one takeaway from this World Cup is a greater desire to dig deeper into the U.S. game. For the U.S. team, maybe join an American Outlaws chapter, get a better sense of the playing pool, start making plans to watch the Gold Cup. As for MLS, it's here and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere. I can't go to Old Trafford, but I can go to Crew Stadium or Toyota Park or Castech or Archer Stadium or any number of venues. The window of freedom that my sabbaticals provide is quickly closing, and soon it's back to real life. I'll remember this time fondly, and of a tournament that allowed me to learn a little more about football, the world, and myself. Thanks to everyone who came on this journey with me. Thanks to all of my guests and everyone who listened and downloaded and shared these episodes. I plan to be back in the fall with new episodes of the Soccer Nomad podcast and new posts to the Soccer Nomad blog. Until then, ta-ta!